The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
Who rules over you? Simply find out who you're not allowed to criticize. You are listening to HCH. I'm Andy, your host, and today is a special Sunday show. I've just got off the phone with Dave Gahari. I'm very tired. I'm generally in bed by now on a Sunday night, but I recorded what was going to be a segment for the Limeys tomorrow, which will still go out, but it ended up being over an hour on Dave's experiences with the COVID bioweapon. So I'm going to play that for you now. Here we go, folks. Okay, folks. Today is Sunday, January the 16th. It's just gone 7:30 in the evening my time in the UK. And it's the first time that I've got to speak to my dear friend Dave Gahari since he had his well-documented illness. The last time we spoke was via video link on Sunday, September the 19th of 2021, when he was in a hospital bed. And I'm delighted to be able to speak to him again now. And so, Dave, I'm going to bring you up right now. Dave, are you with us?
I am, Andy, and it's great to be here, and always great to talk to you. We've been close friends for quite some time, and we've been through a lot together in reference to the state of publishing in both of our countries and trying to get information out there. So it's great to be here, and I'm looking forward to discussing what we're going to discuss today.
Absolutely. And before you were hospitalized, you were in touch, and I think you've been traveling. There have been some situations that you had to deal with, and you've become very ill. And we were sort of messaging back and forth, and I was a bit confused as to what was going on. Then we had our conversation on September 19th. But can you let the audience know what has actually happened to you in these last 4 months?
Yeah. Yeah, it's going on 5 months now, but the traveling was in relation to my mom. So my mom turned 89 in June, and that's a nice long life. But of course, most people would want their mom to be, or to go forever. And she had taken a turn for the worse. And what happened was that she wasn't going to make it. And it coincided, or at least her spiral down coincided with us, myself, my wife, and my son getting what appeared to be COVID. And the way that it manifested itself for myself and my wife, Simona, was that you just wanted to, you were exhausted. You just wanted to lie in bed and sleep. And then in my case, along with the sleep came uncontrolled, spurts of diarrhea while I was lying down. And that went on. It's funny. Usually I'm pretty good with keeping track of things that have happened and, how long they've happened. And I can't remember how many days it went on, but we were at the point where we had to hit the road to drive from where we are at in Florida, in the Florida Panhandle, drive to where my mom was at in New Jersey. And it's about 1,200 miles. And we kept going. I remember we went from day to day and said, okay, well, we only have 2 days left before we need to go. And to get there in time for the wake, because she passed on August 26th. And so this was obviously the wake was, let me see, I'll tell you. The wake was September 2nd. So August 26th was a Thursday, and the wake was on the following Thursday. So we had to give ourselves 2 days, 3 days. We were planning on being there on Monday evening to get settled, and then we would have Tuesday and Wednesday. And then we said, well, if we get there Tuesday evening, we'll at least have Wednesday. And then that was the 31st. Then we realized it was just too close and we weren't going to make it. There would be no way to do it. So that was the traveling end of what coincided with this, the attack of the bioweapon on us. Now, my son, my 14-year-old son, Matt, he just shook it off in 2 days, which was, typical of children, that they're rarely, affected in a negative way by this bioweapon. And what happened was that one of my brothers told us, or told my wife on the phone that, in Florida, and of course we should have known this, but we didn't, Florida, they have some stuff set up throughout the state, different points throughout the state that Governor DeSantis got going, where you could go in and get these, what are called monoclonal antibody infusion injections. And you just need to do it once. And it's one of these treatments that works, which is why the federal government and the states that are more inclined to being controlled by Democrats don't want, because they, for some very odd reason, they don't want anything but this experimental therapy that they call a vaccine, which it's not a vaccine, and I have not had a vaccine, and I'm never going to have it because it's not a vaccine. And so we looked and we found the the site, the closest monoclonal site. And Simona says, I don't know how I drove there, but I did. I don't remember that it was a problem. But I drove down there, and it was about, let's say, 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes to get to the site. And, we went in and went through, filled out some paperwork, and they brought Simona in behind the curtain there. There were a good number of people there, to get it. And what happened was the nurse said I couldn't get it. And the reason was because my oxygen absorption was too low. Now, whether or not that was the case, I don't know. All I know is that I was too uninformed and obviously unaware what lie before me if I didn't get this. So in 3 days, and I'm fast-forwarding a little bit, but in 3 days, Simona had turned the corner, and she felt great. So she also used ivermectin, and I think she used hydroxychloroquine too, but maybe not. I tried the ivermectin, but because of an injury I had when I was in the Navy, it actually stimulated my nerve pain, so I stopped it. But nonetheless, I wasn't allowed to get the monoclonal antibody infusion injections, which probably would have prevented what I went through. So after she got it, and after we accepted this nurse's decision, which of course, as I said, if I knew then what I know now, I would have fought as she would have, Simona would have, tooth and nail to allow me to get that shot. And I told Simona that I think I need to go to the hospital. And we opted for the military hospital at the base that's nearby here. And the reason I did, and this was September 6th, which was also Labor Day here in America. And I opted for that because it was close by, number one. And number two is that I had been there before. My VA doctor had sent me over for like an x-ray or something. And I remember it was an efficient hospital. And so we went there. They gave me the rapid test that came out negative. And then they gave me the other test. I don't know what the name of it is. Maybe PCR test. Improved PCR test. And that came out positive. And then they rushed me, quickly into the facility, into the hospital, and got me all ready to admit me and put me on a COVID ward. And of course, I was happy that I would be tended to, or I thought I would be tended to. And Simona and Matt went home, and I finally got into a room. And that was September 6th. We spoke, as you said, about 2 weeks after that. Simona had brought in my laptop, and I got to go on it because I was feeling okay. I wasn't feeling great. It was just that I wasn't feeling terrible, as well, but it was still, you could see that there was something happening. And what happened at that point was they were trying to, because this bioweapon attacks the lungs, and that's its most, I think, significant contribution to humanity, is it attacks the lungs. Of course, it's a respiratory disease. And it was attacking my lungs, and so the respiratory therapists there, primarily one. She was wonderful. Was trying different therapies, different machines, different things to, have the lungs built up. Well, what happened was around the middle of the following month in October. So obviously I was in there. Simona couldn't come and visit me because I was in isolation, and I had, they gave me this remdesivir, which if you read some stuff online, it's going to kill you. They gave me actually another version, another manufacturer's monoclonal antibody infusion, which was just released at that point. It may have been too late. You're supposed to use that after like 3-4 days of the onset of symptoms. And apparently I wasn't improving, but I crashed. And I had found out a lot of this stuff just relatively recently. So, you know, I had sat in other hospitals, which I'll get to, without knowing this stuff and really without wanting to know what actually happened. Of course, and I didn't know this either, Simona knew all this stuff because she was there, you know, quarterbacking the whole thing and being involved to such a degree that, you know, she had become a staple there at the hospital and over the phone. When she wasn't there, she would call to inquire about my condition. The hospital was about, let's say, 45 minutes away from our home, maybe a little less, and depending on traffic. But what happened was in the middle of October, I took a turn for the worse, which I didn't remember this when my lungs crashed. But when Simone and I were talking about this, maybe about a week ago or so, she reminded me of something that I remembered, which was that one of the doctors was saying that, you know, we want to put him on the ventilator. And Simona was adamant about me not getting on the ventilator. And the doctor said, basically, well, if he doesn't get on the ventilator now, we have some time to, you know, have a positive impact on him. He's going to get on the ventilator tomorrow, and he's going to be a lot worse. So I told Simona that, and I think I should go on the ventilator. And again, I don't remember this clearly, but I do remember it like in a fog, you know, that I think I should go on the ventilator, even though we've all heard such drastic things about ventilators. And she said, or she made me promise that I would come back to her. And I said, I promise I will. You know, not that I really had any control over it, or maybe I did just by saying that. But I went on the ventilator, and I don't remember anything after that because they, you know, they give you medication and they put you in a coma, and you're out of it. And I was out of it. So from the middle of October, I then was transferred to another hospital with the ventilator. And again, Simona was there in that first hospital, monitoring me, telling the doctors and the nurses how she wanted to proceed, you know, with treatment. You know, they were, you know, doing things that didn't make sense to her, you know, medicating me a certain way, giving me too much medicine, repeating things. And then this happens in hospitals. You know, and whether or not it was the first hospital or the second, I'm not clear on. But at any rate, I went to another hospital in a different town in Pensacola, which was about, I guess, an hour away from the first hospital. And I didn't remember going in an ambulance, which apparently I did, and getting to that hospital. And at that hospital in ICU is where I flatlined. And they brought me back to life with CPR. And the prognosis was never good. It was always, he's not going to make it. You know, prepare for that. He's only going to last a few more hours. And Simona told them, he's going to make it. And really, I went through a lot up to that point, but I can't say that I went through more than my wife did, holding everything together, you know, the life, the family. My family, almost all my family, came from all around the country and was there for 2 weeks to support her, to see me when she was being told that I'm dying and that I will be dead. And she wouldn't accept that. And at this other facility, from the middle of October, I was there until December 10, and I was on this ventilator, and a ventilator is, you know, not, I guess, what a lot of people might think they are, you know, some kind of an iron lung type machine. You know, basically, they have something in your, you know, your throat area, and it's monitored on a computer screen, and eventually I had a tracheotomy. They put a trach in there. And at that point, you can't talk. You don't have any voice because the vocal cords are not engaged. And, you know, people, nurses, et cetera, Simona, whoever, would have to be adept at reading lips because there's no sound coming out. And as time went on, I didn't die, and I had the ventilator removed. I was improving, and so I got off the ventilator, and of course, the lungs were still very weak, and in the hospital beds, you know, one of the problems was that, for example, let's say I'm lying on my back, and that's fine, and I've got, you know, a certain number in my oxygen absorption, which is good, because I'm just lying on my back, I'm not moving. Let's say I was, well, at that point, I wasn't able to move on my own. I couldn't even lift my arms up. It was like I was paralyzed. But let's say in this case, one of the nurses wants to roll me over on my side without any help from me. Just that movement would crash my oxygen numbers. So it wasn't like I was in the bed and I could do whatever I want. I could do nothing. I was dead, you know, impossible to move. So I had to build up from that to being able to, you know, reach my arm or lift my arm, reach it over, grab one of the side rails and try to pull to assist in them, you know, cleaning me, because you could not control, you know, the urination, although they have devices that, you know, sometimes work and sometimes don't. You could not control the bowel movements. So it was, you know, a constant mess. And the food was being delivered through a tube. You couldn't eat. I had a feeding tube in me, which gave me all of these nutrients, as well as, of course, an IV that brought in some other stuff. And then there was, you know, the various pharmaceuticals that were being applied to me. And at some point, it reached a level where, you know, I was saying, Simona was saying, the doctors were saying, the nurses were saying, it's time, you know, it's getting close to the time that he should be transferred to the next facility, which is a rehab facility. And of course, the main thing that was preventing that was the level of oxygen that was required. So they couldn't just take you from, you know, one place to the other on a lot of oxygen, because they're just not equipped to do that. And ambulances, and it's not allowed, you know. And everything is controlled by the insurance companies primarily, you know, that dictates, you know, where you could go, how long you could stay there, so on. So we got the oxygen level down. It was improving. You know, a lot of the nurses who saw me in ICU and the condition I was in, and of course they remembered that I wasn't supposed to make it, when they did see me in the outside of ICU in my room, many of them were deeply impacted emotionally, and some of them cried because it was a miracle to them. And one of the things I found out about nursing, because I never really knew about it, the nursing profession, it's an amazing profession that these nurses do whatever they have to do. And not all of them, but, you know, most of them, you know, do whatever they have to do to make you comfortable. And the other part of nurses that I was able to see is that one of the things that, perhaps the thing that, the main thing that nurses get excited about is when the patients under their care improve. So this is the one thing that they pretty much all of them want to see. You know, that just gets them so excited, because they've seen the other side of it also, where they haven't improved, and they've seen a lot of death over these last 2 years, and a lot of people dying without the family being able to be next to them when they died. A lot of the nurses got emotional when they compared what I was like in ICU to what I was like at that point. And we're talking in November. And eventually I did get transferred to the rehab facility, also in Pensacola. And I went into an ambulance. I remember that because that was the first time I was outside since September 6th, except for that ambulance ride in the middle of October, which I was unaware of. But so it was nice being outside after so long, almost 3 months. Actually, no, it was longer than 3 months. So it was September 6th to December 10th. And I was in that rehab facility where they gave 3 hours of rehab per day. And then basically, and that doesn't count the weekends. And then basically, the rest of the time, you were constrained to your bed, which had alarms on it. The wheelchair had alarms. So the hospital before the rehab facility, I was able to sit up at the edge of the bed unsupervised, which is good because you're repositioning the lungs. And so at this facility, it was just a mere 3 hours of therapy Monday through Friday, and the rest of the time, nothing. So when I was finally discharged about 2 weeks ago on December 30th to come home, well, they had delivered to the room, I think maybe the day before, a machine called an oxygen concentrator, which just plugs into the power at home and brings in air and then separates the oxygen from the air. Excuse me. And like right now, I am getting that oxygen delivered to me through, you know, a hose and that cannula through my nose. So that plus they delivered a tank, you know, and so you've seen those metal tanks, I guess, painted green. And that's what we used to exit the rehab facility, was a portable tank that, you know, they showed us how to do it. And Simona really has been doing everything. I'm just about useless. You know, she, you know, set it all up, secured it, got me hooked up, you know, made this swap from me being in a wheelchair into the car. And so we left and we made that that trip, you know, from Pensacola to where we live, Crestview, which is about an hour. And one thing I didn't mention was that when they finally took the, or two things, when they finally took the trach out of me, well, they took it out once and they put a smaller one in, and then they took it out finally for good. And that's, then I was allowed to eat food. And every hospital room had a television in it. And I remember getting to the first hospital and it was running. And I asked the nurse to turn it off because, as you know, and as many people know who have heard me drone on about this, is that I haven't watched TV since 1991. And so I don't have any interest in television. And it wasn't until the second hospital in Pensacola that I actually broke down and turned on the television. And I watched mostly sports, you know, football and the, you know, like that. And which was, you know, good and bad. One of the things that it did was showed me all these food commercials. And because I wasn't able to eat food, and I still had that tube in, I was like obsessing over food. I just needed to eat. I couldn't wait until I could actually get my mouth around food. And finally the day arrived, and it felt good to have, solid food. And then I kind of, lost an appetite. It wasn't like I thought it would be. But one time, one of my brothers got me a pizza, because they always ask, what are you going to eat first? Since you're able to eat now after all this time. And I didn't know. And eventually the only thing I could settle on was some pizza. I was able to eat, I think, one or two slices. But because I lost about 80 pounds in the hospital, my stomach shrunk dramatically. So I can't eat as much as I used to, which is a good thing, I guess. During the time that I was unconscious and in a coma, I also experienced something that I had never experienced before, and that was the hallucinations, which were very vivid and elaborate, and they reached a point where the hallucinations had melded, once I had come out of it, with life, with reality. And it took a while for me to realize that what I thought was true wasn't. I don't know what caused the hallucinations. They don't either. The experts, could have been some of the medication, could have been the effects of being in ICU, some kind of, delusions that you go through when you're in ICU. They don't know for sure, but whatever it was, these things were incredible. And I still remember them, vivid in color. Not crazy things, just like mundane, everyday things. Just very, very odd. I shouldn't say all of them were, because most of them were, but some of them were quite bizarre and scary. And the scariest of the hallucinations were the non-visual ones, where, you could hear voices and, the constant sound of voices, and not being able to stop that, gave me the feeling that something had gotten inside of my head, and, literally it was driving me crazy. That eventually stopped, but the hallucinations again unraveled from reality, and I realized that, I didn't know the people who I thought I knew that I was talking to in my hallucinations until I talked to them in the hospital room, where they said, no, we don't know each other, because I thought that I knew these people, literally, and I had known them for a while. So it was very bizarre. But we made it out of the rehab. We got here home at about 5:30 on Thursday, December 30th. And we were supposed to meet the oxygen company, who I thought was going to unload this like 80-pound concentrator and get us tanks, get us set up. Anyway, they somehow messed it up, and the guy came here, very nice kid, and brought it in and set it up, and I was on oxygen, as I am now, from that machine. So not just oxygen, but, you know, they had dropped off at the rehab facility, a wheelchair, a commode, and a walker. And so, for example, I can stand up now and I can walk, you know, let's say from the office to the kitchen, even without the walker now, because every day you get stronger. But the problem is that not that I can walk, but that what that will do to the oxygen. So it really depletes it. So when your lungs aren't functioning properly, you only have a certain amount of oxygen to use. If you're sitting down in a chair, as I am now, it's fine. But if I stand up and engage my legs, well, what do the legs need to do what they do? They need oxygen. So that draws the oxygen away from my lungs. And literally, if I don't breathe in properly and I just, you know, let it take its course, I can plummet. My oxygen levels can plummet and I could die. So I could, become unconscious and die without the right amount of oxygen. So we have to be prepared for when the power goes out. It hasn't gone out since we got home, fortunately, whether it's a quick, you know, off-on type thing, which can happen sometimes because the machine has to be reset, or whether it's a longer loss of power. We have to be ready to switch to the portable tank. And when I say we, I mean primarily Simona, because without her, I wouldn't be here talking to you for sure. She sets everything up and it's literally like, taking care of a baby, who can't do anything. As I said, though, as I'm sitting at the computer desk, I can do my work and because I'm not jumping up and down or trying to take steps. But, you know, the fact is that this bioweapon does hit the lungs and it treats everyone differently, as I found out, and everyone has a different prognosis. Some people can shrug it off and get better quickly. Others don't ever come back, which has happened a lot. And we're talking even 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds. I'm 61. And, somehow I made it. But there are much younger people who have had the same thing, which is probably this Delta variant, the strongest one, and they didn't make it. So whether or not there are comorbidities or whatever the case may be, this COVID, treats everyone differently, and they don't know, the people who are treating these patients, they don't know what to do. There isn't like a standard formula of how to treat each patient. They have to try everything and anything they can. And it's been a very difficult, anxiety-ridden, adventure for me, which I never had anxiety before in my life, which I developed in the hospital because of, at least what they told me was, the inability to breathe on your own leads to the anxiety. But I'm doing good now. I've been sitting here, trying to catch up with what I missed, the 4 months I missed. It was 1 week shy of 4 months. And there's a lot to be grateful for, especially people such as you, Andy, because I heard many times from people who emailed that, you know, they heard you talking about me and that I was ill and asking for prayers. And it was really heartening when, you know, I get emails and they end with, and then many of them did, was interesting, that telling me that there's a lot of people out there praying for you. And not, you know, looking at that and going, well, how do you know that there's a lot of people out there praying for me? I don't think that, well, I know these people who wrote those emails, they don't know each other. Maybe their only connection is you, but there were a lot of people out there praying for me. And Simona saw it too. Simona was updating everyone via Skype and text and phone, and because there were a bunch of people, you know, curious about what happened. As you know, Andy, you know, I work 7 days a week, and I'm pretty much always here. And when I wasn't, people became concerned. But your regular updating and solicitation of prayers was something, you know, that really had a big impact on me. So I want to thank you for that, my friend.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. And we're going to put this out actually today on the Sunday that we record it. And I don't know. I've got questions to not really questions. You've answered so much. I just want to pay a special tribute. Now, folks, when I said that I was getting updates from Money Tree Publishing, from people working with Dave, these updates were from his wife, Simona. And she has been absolutely wonderful throughout all of this, as Dave has attested to. She's had so much to deal with, and she's just done a fantastic job during such a difficult circumstance. And it was strange because, obviously, you hear stories, people go on a ventilator, that's it. My attitude always was I'd hear these stories and I was like, I don't think about it. I'm just going to keep asking people for the prayers, you know. And I didn't even think that you would necessarily be okay or not. I was just, I'm not going to think about this. I'm just going to go my way. This is all I can do. And that was that. And I'm delighted that, I know it's difficult now, but you've already said that you're improving, which is wonderful. But a quick question, Dave, is that you've referred to what you experienced as both COVID, but more as the bioweapon. Some people say that COVID does not exist. Well, you've obviously had something happen to you, whether it was targeted at you or COVID. What are your thoughts, Dave, on that?
Yes. Prior to being hospitalized or prior to getting it, I had my doubts as to whether it was even real, because I didn't know anybody who had it. I didn't have any firsthand knowledge. I know the garbage in the media and the garbage in government and governments were pushing this fake vaccine, and I just didn't trust them. So what I realized by with my experience and by communicating with the nurses who really are in the front line of all this stuff. You know, we talk about, you know, well, is it a conspiracy? know, or does it exist at all? Well, you know, if you have this many nurses, it would probably be mathematically impossible to, you know, silence them all. And what I learned from them was that, you know, they've actually been in the COVID fight for 2 years, and it's had an impact on them. You know, many times they left work, you know, in tears in the car, thinking about the person they had been tending to dying, with their family members not being able to be near them. And that made me realize that, you know, whatever it is, and I call it a bioweapon because I think it was engineered by people, that it's not natural, that there was this gain of function research. And they're not obviously, you know, researching it, studying it, devoting resources to finding out more about it, because they don't want to. They didn't want Jeffrey Epstein alive. He's not alive anymore, supposedly. You know, they didn't want the steel from the Twin Towers lying around Manhattan because they were part of the crime scene. So they got rid of it. You know, this is the way it works. So they don't want to study the origins of COVID, the bioweapon. They want to keep it silent, and they want to keep cramming the fake vaccine down our throats. So there's a lot not to trust about it, but there's also the reality that I know now that whatever this thing is, it's real and it sucks.
Yes, absolutely. And Dave, before we go, is there, firstly, I want to let the audience know, Dave is a tremendously hard worker. You know that he is my publisher. He circulates my books along with many other books on moneytreepublishing.com. Dave has not, well, he's had 4 months out of his life, folks, you know. And I urge you to support him. He offers so many other titles that you'd be aware of, the likes of the DVD set Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told by Dennis Wise, with his follow-up on The New World Order. And then, of course, you've got Hellstorm, you've got the audio book, you've got the video, you've got the book, and many other books on monetary publishing. But Dave, what other sites have you got where people can support your work at this critical time?
Yes, Andy. Well, of course, you mentioned monetary publishing, where your book, Synagogue of Satan, Expanded, Revised, and Uncensored, is available. And that is the most popular offering we have. And of course, we deliver these products all around the world. And there's been a recent issue with a couple of countries, primarily Australia and to a lesser extent New Zealand, because we have a lot of our products go to Australia. A lot go to Canada, a lot go to the UK. But because of this disruption with COVID, there are certain methods of delivery done by the USPS, the United States Postal Service, that has disrupted primarily here Australia and New Zealand, where it would cost, let's say, $29.75 to get your book from here in the United States, Florida, to Australia. Well, because the USPS removed First Class Package International and Priority Mail, and when the weight of anything goes above 4 pounds, it automatically becomes Priority Mail. So they removed those two options. And so instead of a customer paying $29.75 to get a copy of The Synagogue of Satan shipped from Florida to Australia, they're asking them to pay $79.10 just for the shipping. So I would say to these people living in Australia, which is really unfortunate what they've done to that country, and New Zealand, and other countries impacted by the decision of the USPS, to email us, and we'll explain how we're handling that, because we are handling it in such a way that they can still get what they want for the exact same price that they were paying before this suspension. So that really has taken a lot out of our sales to those two countries. And there are other countries too. But we also have another publishing imprint, Moonrock Books, which are primarily Jim Fetzer conspiracy books. Conspiracy in the sense of, giving alternative views of how something happened, why it happened, and not just accepting the mainstream conventional wisdom. There's also another imprint called Turning the Tide Publishing, which has some books that don't fit into the Money Tree imprint or the Moonrock Books imprint. And then finally, of course, there is the Rockstar Publishing, which is erasingtheliberty.com, which talks about the USS Liberty massacre, which I still am working on the revision for that, and that will be done this year. So, and hopefully that's the final word on the Liberty, getting as close as possible to giving an explanation of what happened and why it happened. So those are the four imprints. Of course, if someone would go to MoneyTreePublishing.com, right on the menu bar, you'll see the initials of ETL, MRB, TTP, and so you can access all of them from one site.
And also, folks, Dave doesn't shaft you on shipping. And so any books that you order from those four sites, they get funneled via your shipping address and they get looked at individually and you get charged the shipping that Dave pays, not some sort of bit on the top that a lot of other people do to try and make money on shipping. So feel free to navigate those four sites, pick out what you want, and then Dave will put them together in the order and get them shipped to you. Am I correct there, Dave?
Yeah, that's right. We just the way that it works, we use a in what's called the back end. It links up with USPS, so the rates that you see on the site on Money Tree Publishing, let's say, are the same that you would see if you went to the USPS website and plugged in the zip code of where it's coming from and where it's going. So they're going to be identical. The only time that's different is if there's a flat rate charge for something like the T-shirts at Erasing the Liberty, or if somebody opted for priority, which you don't have to. You can just get media mail. And again, it's identical to what the USPS charges. And I know there There are companies that, charge more. We've all dealt with that. Like, what do you mean the shipping's $18? You know, getting a, you know, whatever it is. But yeah, we try to keep everything reasonable for the customers. And sometimes, for example, I mentioned that Australia matter. Of course, Simona had to take over everything without me even there to give her some advice or pointers about how to do things. And there was one order which I was going through. Part of what I do is, I go through every order to make sure that it was done right and that the right, for example, shipping was charged. And there was one order that, because it happened at a time when they did that, when USPS did that, and very few people were aware what happened. But this person in November, the beginning of November, when I was obviously in the hospital, she got your book and she paid $79.10 for shipping. Well, the other day, maybe about 4 days ago, when I found it, I refunded her. I think it was $49.45. I emailed her, told her what happened. Never heard back, which many times you don't, but that's fine. We're not doing it for recognition. We're doing it because she was charged the wrong amount. So she paid $79.10. She should have paid $29.75. So we just obviously took $79.10 minus $29.75 and refunded her the rest. So we just want to treat everybody exactly the same. There are some people who ask for discounts. We don't have discounts, and we're not going to give somebody a discount when the next person or the person before them and the next person is not going to be getting a discount. So it's a very simple model to follow. We keep everything clean and neat and treat everybody the same. And we have a great team, you know, including our tech genius, who you, Andy, introduced us to. So that makes it a lot easier to get this stuff done. So, people, if they're interested in banned and censored books and DVDs, that's the place to go.
Thank you so much, Dave. And I won't mention the name of our tech genius because, I don't actually ask him if I could or I couldn't, but he's wonderful. He knows who he is and he's probably listening today. And he pulled me out of a hole this weekend after my website went down for 15 and a half hours. I apologise, folks, if I'm a bit croaky, but I'm generally in bed by this time. But I was delighted to be able to speak to Dave and get this special broadcast out to you. So I'm going to be up a little bit longer to get it typed up. And many of you will be surprised to see a show going up on a Sunday from me. I would also like to add that Dave is exceptionally honest. He publishes my books and he sells my books. Now, he might sell 10 times the amount of books and pay me a royalty based on a tenth of that amount, but he doesn't. And I know he doesn't because I trust him and I've known him for years. But what I'm getting at is that at the end of the day, it's based upon trust. The fact that I can rely on Dave to be honest, as he is with me and he will be with you, as he just demonstrated. And the other thing that I'd like to mention again is to thank Simona so much. She's been through a hell of a lot with Dave not knowing the outcome in hospital, having to deal with the family and to deal with that. She has been through a tremendous amount. Whilst Dave has to have the oxygen at the moment, he's spoken for an hour. He's definitely on the right track. He's definitely getting better. But please keep your prayers coming for Dave's recovery and also for Simona. The strength that she has had to keep everything together. Moonrock Books, Turning the Tide, Money Tree Publishing, Rockstar Publishing, has only survived thanks to her sterling hard work while Dave has been incapacitated, and we're delighted to have him back. Dave, any last message for the audience before we go?
Yes, thank you for, you know, as I said earlier, for making the issue known to your listeners and asking for the prayer. You're 100% right about Simona. I didn't know the extent of it until much later. I still don't know the full extent of it. I still haven't read messages, emails, seen photographs. I just don't have the energy to do it. But she did, as you said, it was something that she rose to the occasion and she did it. And, you know, there may be folks out there who question, you know, the effectiveness of prayer. I can tell you that there were many times that I became emotional when I was hospitalized. And I don't ordinarily have a reason to be emotional like that, where I'm actually, you know, crying. One of them was when I saw, you know, what the nursing industry was all about and, you know, the dedication that these nurses have. Another was when I was informed about, you know, your regular request for prayers and bringing this matter to the attention of all your listeners, and the emails I got. That had an impact on me. So praying is something that I was raised on. You know, we would drop to our knees before bed. My mom would have us pray. You know, I went to a Baptist church for 12 years. I did get away from religion in my teenage years when I thought what mattered most was just having fun, hanging out with the boys and, you know, having some beers, not getting up early on a Sunday. But does prayer work? Well, I can't say for sure, but I can say that it definitely made me feel great knowing that there are so many people out there who, because you don't know, you know, I mean, that's something that many people would question, you know, who really would care if I died? Well, from what you did, Andy, I see that a lot of people would, and that had a great impact on me. So, you know, for you know, the question of does prayer work? Well, it's definitely something that is positive, and it may have some kind of other powers. I don't know, but would I want to have gone through this without the prayer, without knowing what I know now? Probably not. So does it work? Don't know for sure, but it certainly is worth it, and I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dave. That brings us to the end of today's Sunday show. I want to call it, I've written down how the COVID bioweapon nearly killed me. I think that's accurate, and I'm delighted that Dave has overcome it and continues to get better. Back tomorrow on the line is. Thanks for listening, folks, and bye for now.